Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
Well, I was ready to go with just some all sorts of really important stuff. I mean, the conclave and electing a new pope and homosexuality and gay marriage and the collapse of civilization. I've had to put it all on hold because something far more important than all of that has just come to my attention, and we have to lead off with the amazing, astounding story. You look completely lost in there. You have no idea where I'm going, dude. Oh, and that is, I just learned that the news has just broken. The president was in the middle of a speech, and he had to stop because all the reporters ran out of the room. And because they're covering this amazing story, Peter Lumpkins has written a book on Calvinism. Oh, my goodness. Oh, I can just hear some people, well, you haven't read it yet. It might be really good. Oh, yes. The amazing thing is that it's everything you need to know about Calvinism and then some. Oh, I can't wait. That'll probably take about 20 miles to polish off. And it's just in time for the 2013 John 3:16 conference. Yes, when you put on one debacle, repeat it a few years later. Why not? Yes, go to Peter Lumpkin's blog and you will discover what is Calvinism. Is there a link somewhere here? I mean, I'm sort of... Well, that's the front cover. Where can you? Because I just want to be one of Peter's first reviewers. I bet you anything that he will be so kind he'll send me a copy. What do you think? No, I don't think so. Oh, well. Anyway, I'm looking forward to that. An exclusive biblical learning series presented by Free Church Press. I'm looking forward to that. I'm just sort of looking through some of the comments here. Yeah, Peter, how does one go about purchasing these books? And somebody, oh noes, first a John 3:16 conference and now gasp, books about Calvinism. But they're not written by Calvinist idols teaching us all how to be good little Calvinists. How divisive. Only Calvinists are allowed to write about Calvinism. What do these traditionalists think they are? If they knew anything about Calvinism, they'd be Calvinists. That's what Mary said. Well, I look forward to reading everything you need to know about Calvinism and then some.
I'm looking through the archives here trying to find something appropriate to play for this, and the Southern Baptist National Anthem is the only thing I can think of.
No,
don't play that.
No. Not happening. But there you go, folks. There it is. That's our lead story for today. Now, moving on to actually important things that might have meaning. There is no question about the fact that the world is currently looking toward Rome. The conclave will begin in the not-too-distant future, and who knows, 2 or 3 days after that, the white smoke will usher forth from the chimney, and there will be a new pretender to sit upon a non-existent throne, et cetera, et cetera. It is amazing to listen to the Ecumenists today, who are just all a Twitter about who the new Pope is going to be and how important this is. And we all should, even if you don't believe that the Pope is the Vicar of Christ, this should be really important to you and all the rest of the stuff. Well, yesterday, I was witness to a Lazarus incident with my MacBook Pro. I had to take it to the, this first time I'm sitting here, I've got two MacBook Pros in front of me. My first one, my second one. This is my third one. It's my new one. It's my main one. It's the one that's got the big drive and I do the videos on and stuff like that. It decided to go to sleep for a while. It decided to just die. And so I took it over there and they resurrected it and it's living again. But like Lazarus, we'll someday die again. So that's where it's not a real resurrection in that sense, because then it would never die again, and then it would be worth a lot of money. But it will die again someday. But I was, unfortunately, you have to make appointments with the geniuses at Apple. And hey, the lady did a good job, so I guess we should call her a genius. But unfortunately, mine was at 4:30 in the afternoon, which means I got out of there right about 5, and I am in a bad part of Phoenix as far as traffic is concerned. I'm just trying to get back across the valley, and there are some places, especially along Glendale Avenue, that are just really slow, bumper to bumper. And so I'm listening to Hugh Hewitt. Now, Hugh Hewitt is an interesting guy. He's a smart guy. He knows everybody. He has talked with everybody. I mean, talk about somebody who just knows. I mean, he is just the man. But he's also a PCUSA elder. I think it's PCUSA. I'm pretty sure it's PCUSA. Which means he ain't exactly the most conservative guy when it comes to theology. And he is such a good ecumenist. And he was mentioning at the beginning of the program that he was going to be having a fellow on to talk about the enclave. And it was quite interesting. The fellow by his name is George Weigel. And he has a new book out called Evangelical Catholicism. I threw it on the minister resource list last night in Kindle form, and someone's already been kind enough, thank you very much, you know who you are, to purchase that for me. And the subtitle is Deep Reform in the 21st Century Church. Well, it was interesting to listen to him talk about phrases like Semper Reformanda and things like that. I appreciate hearing that. I like hearing that. I don't know how that works when you're a Roman Catholic, because the church is infallible. And there was a historical context to Semper Reformanda. The context he put it in was always learning to love God better. Well, that sounds real nice. But what about, you know, like the teachings of the church? Well, those really aren't up for grabs. Those have been infallibly defined already. I did see an article. I saw an article this morning that I guess Phil Johnson had linked to that seemed to indicate some real problems in the Curia in Rome and that this had something to do with the Pope's resignation. I don't know. Maybe. I mean, it was talking about tremendous amount of corruption and sexual scandals and stuff in the Curia, in Rome, amongst the cardinals themselves, and all this type of stuff. I don't know. Theologically, Rome doesn't have the Gospels, so you get a bunch of people with a lot of power together, and yeah, that kind of thing could happen. But I don't know. But I do know that very few people are really... See, I've been talking about this for years. Our society... Western society as a whole, whether it's the United States, Canada, European countries, Western-style countries that have had large amounts of freedom for quite some time, are stuck in a cycle of just repeating the same stupid things that they keep doing over and over again. The young generation today, history? What's history? I don't know anything about history. I'm not connected with history. I don't care about what my grandparents and great-grandparents fought for. I don't care what they sacrificed for. I don't care who they fought. And the fact that my professor at my community college is spewing the same garbage as the people they fought against only 40 years ago. I don't care. That's cool. He's neat. And so you just see this rise of, with the European Union and the kind of totalitarian thinking and the suppression of freedom of religion and freedom of thought and all the rest of this stuff that we are seeing happening at such an amazing rate of speed. And in that context, we are, by necessity, forced ever more closely together with Roman Catholics who are conservative in their worldview, like we are. And what's happening is people who already didn't know why they weren't Roman Catholics are either becoming Roman Catholics or they're adopting the viewpoint that, eh, I don't like them. And those guys look silly in those hats and the long robes, and I'm not interested in any of that kind of stuff. The smells and bells really don't attract me, so I'm not concerned about that. That's their things. That's good. You know, we've got our charismatic brothers, and they do their thing, and the Pentecostal brothers do their thing, and Phillips Craig and Dean does their thing, and. Trinitarian, not so sure about Trinitarian. We're all together. The world detests all of us. They don't make differentiation between us. They don't care. So, you know, let's just all get together. Let's just all cooperate. And I've been talking about this for a long time. I really have. You can go back. You listen to the Wayback Machine, you can go back many years, and I've been talking about the fact that the more and more we live in a post-Christian and anti-Christian society, the more we're going to have to be very, 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 very clear, very clear on what we believe the gospel is and what we believe the gospel is not. And listening to this, evangelical Catholicism, you're just going to be looked at as if you are out in the middle of nowhere. You just don't want to cooperate with anybody. You're just a curmudgeon. If you dare say things like, well, you know, there is a thing about purgatory, you know, who cares about purgatory? The society's coming after us. You hear that? Well, I care about purgatory. Because why is the society coming after me? Well, there can be a lot of different reasons. But the only solution is called the gospel, and the gospel is denied by things like purgatory and the mass and transubstantiation and priestly absolution and all the rest of that stuff, including the office of the papacy. But you're not hearing almost any of that, or if you are, that's all you're hearing. In other words, there's no... You know, you get the knee-jerk reaction of the, oh, well, Satan's having to select his next spawn or something like that, rather than any kind of meaningful, historically based demonstration that this office did not exist in the primitive church, it's not 2,000 years old, this isn't how Christ organized his church, etc., etc., etc. You've either got the ecumenists who just go, well, you know, it's just the way it is now. You know, you got to deal with history, so don't worry about it. Or you've got the real rabid folks that go the other direction. And anyways, that's what we got. So, evangelical Catholicism. I haven't read it yet. Like I said, I just got it this morning on Kindle. And I wasn't writing this morning, so I didn't get it finished. Didn't even get it recorded yet. But we'll get to it. And... really going to be interested. I am interested, by the way. I'm not saying that this shouldn't be covered. I'm going to be very, very interested. If they choose a reformist pope, a young reformist pope, everyone's eyeing the fellow from the Philippines, only 56 years old. Now, I think I heard Weigel say that I think only 8% of the cardinals are under 65. So obviously that means a real, probably still going to go toward the old line perspective on things. But we'll see. But if you get a real reformist pope in there, how is he going to be a reformist pope? In fact, it was interesting. And I wanted to mention this on the Dividing Line. There's so many times I hear things when I'm out and about, and I go, oh, I've got to talk about that on the Dividing Line. I've got to talk about it on the Dividing Line. And then I'm old, and so I forget. So I really need to put on my phone. I actually have one, but I need to get a audio note taker type thing that will just allow me to hit it, record the thing, and then it's going to come back and yell at me, you know, the next day, did you remember to do this? There are so many millions of apps out there. I bet you there is something like that out there.
Now that you're riding a bent, you could...
Almost.
You just take your hands off and steer with your feet.
No. You don't understand the... Now you have to explain that. And I'm riding a bent. Yes, I am riding a bent. I have expanded my cycling challenges. I've added to my corral of machines a recumbent bike. But it's not one of those that you see out in Sun City with three wheels. This is, for those of you who know anything about, an SWB USS, short wheelbase, under seat steering, which means it's extremely squirrely. It is meant for going fast and for digging tight in turns and doing all that kind of stuff, but I'm just learning how to ride it, and let me tell you something, that is a different world. I feel like an absolute noob. The first time I've ever done it, you know, I am an amateur again, but I'm picking it up pretty quick. So anyways, no, you do not take your hands off and maybe down the road someplace, but you got to realize that front tire is only controlled by my hands. It not my feet. So I can't do nothing about that. So that ain't gonna work. Anyhow, what was I talking about? Yes. I was going to mention, you know, you're awful lucky I remembered this. Because 90% anymore, I would have forgotten after that interruption where I was going with this. But one of the things that Weigel said yesterday reminded me of something I heard Jimmy Akin saying shortly after the news of the resignation of Benedict XVI came out. And it just makes me, if I had hair, I'd be pulling it out. I really would. Well, I do, actually, yes, you're reminding me. And Clementine finally got her fingers into it last night. I've grown my goatee out. Some of you have seen the debates from Trinity, Dublin. Some of you can see my white goatee from a long distance off now because it's much longer than it used to be. And I grew it out so that Clementine would have something to grab. Because when Josh and Summer were born, I had a full beard. And they just love to grab up there and just grab hold of a pull like anything. It feels so great. So I wanted her to be able to have a chance to do that. So I've grown it out, but it wants me to. I did not think about pulling my goatee out at this particular point in time. But Weigel said it, Akin said it. They're both talking about an authentic interpretation of, and you're sitting there going, "Oh, you mean authentic interpretation of Romans?" Maybe Romans 5:1, therefore I haven't been justified by faith, you have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Maybe there's an authentic interpretation now of what that means over against Roman Catholic teaching. No, an authentic interpretation has been provided by John Paul II and Benedict XVI of Lumen Gentium and the documents of Vatican II. And they're talking about how now we've got two popes that have given us genuine interpretation. Which means there was a lot of non-genuine interpretation, huh? I mean, there's a lot of argumentation about how these documents were to be interpreted. And here you have the allegedly infallible interpreter, which you and I can't survive with because we're just left with the Bible, you know? You just got the Bible. You know, you don't know what the Bible teaches without Rome.
What does Vatican II teach?
Well, you don't know. Without the authentic interpretation provided by these folks. And when they come up, and then, of course, when they gave their interpretation, then someone's going to have to authentically interpret their interpretation. And it just goes on and on and on. And I'm like, do you not see this, Jimmy Akin? Do you not hear what you're saying? You can stand there and say that sola scriptura is the blueprint for anarchy and then turn around and you know that anything the Pope says then becomes subject to interpretation, doesn't it? Ah, yes, it most assuredly does. It most assuredly does. Ah, it is amazing to listen to. It really, really is amazing to listen to. But obviously, the conclave is important. The next pope is going to be important. And the thing to me that I've pointed out from church history, our Roman Catholic friends sit there thinking that because, well, we've got the Pope. We have the infallible vicar of Christ. Well, you know what? How John Paul II interpreted things, Benedict XVI, fairly close. Not identical, but fairly close. But who's the next guy up? And what if he has a different perspective? Remember what happened with Honorius? Remember what happened with Honorius? Oh, let's not think about that. Let's not think about that. Let's not think about that. Anyway, so I'll see if I can give you a little report on evangelical Catholicism somewhere down the road. But as it is, I really, really, really want to finish Sahih Muslim, and I want to get to the Muwatta of Malik. I want to have those three done. And they're getting the majority of my time right now. I'm starting to record the NT Wright stuff, but I've got a lot of stuff going on in there. I really do. Abdullah Kunda's in channel. So, hi, Abdullah. Maybe you're listening. I don't know. Let's find a way to get me back down to Australia. Hey, you know, if I'm going to South Africa, any direct flights from South Africa to Sydney? I wonder how that would be a... I'd just be in the air a long time if I did something like that. But man, I could make chairmans one year. That would be incredible. I mean, chairman is a level in my flight fund stuff, and looks like I'm going to be getting to the next level this year, which means I need to re-rent that movie with Tom Hanks where he lives in the airport, because then that'll sort of give me some hints as to how I can get through my everyday. Anyhow, I do have some stuff queued up. I have a lot of stuff queued up, actually, that I want to get to. And so let me actually get to what I had queued up earlier, and then get to what I was working on today. I want to at least spend a few moments on these subjects. We have such a diverse listening audience that... Maybe one way that everyone can sort of learn more is if I do shorter segments on different topics rather than just doing one topic the whole hour. Now, it's obviously easier on me to stay with one topic. But since I started off with a subject I wasn't going to spend the whole hour on, then maybe I can mix a few others in here. And there's actually, believe it or not, a relationship between these. We have been, over the past number of months, reviewing the debate between Daniel Wallace and Bart Ehrman on the subject of the New Testament. I'm concerned about one aspect here. This was the debate, of course, where Dan Wallace specifically announced the discovery of first century papyri, or at least what are alleged to be first century papyri of Mark, and a number of second century papyri. And at the time, the announced publication date from Brill was last month. Now, that was 6 months down the road back then, but you may have noticed February, which is what we were told back then, has come and gone. And we are now into March. And whenever Dan is asked anything about this now, his standard response is, I have signed an agreement not to say anything more about this. So, what does that mean? Now, delays in publishing, nothing new. But I was certainly hoping to have been given some information by now as to at least what the name of the book would be, how can we put it on pre-order, et cetera, so we can get in immediately. It's coming from Brill, which means we have to take out a loan to get it. Seriously, I mean, I would be shocked. I would be honestly shocked if this book was anything less than $169 per copy. I would be shocked. And I would guess it'll probably be about $289. I'd put it in the upper $200s to $300 range from Brill, because they know there's actually going to be an enough interest in this that they can ask whatever they want. And it'll still be picked up just because of the value of the information within it. So this is that particular dividing line or debate that was taking place. And so the very next statement that I was do we need to take a break here? I know who's yes. Never mind. We don't need to take a break. The very next portion of the debate that we're going to listen to, I think, is so important, and that we understand what Bart Ehrman's saying. So I'm actually going to back it up to something we've already covered, and then make some comments on it. Here's Bart Ehrman.
What is our basis of knowledge for that? I would like him to address that question, and let me make it more specific. How do we know that our surviving manuscripts were copied from accurate copies instead of thoroughly erroneous ones? I'm not asking whether the later manuscripts, after the year 900, were accurately copying their predecessors. How do we know that our earliest copies were preserving accurate copies of accurate copies? How do we know that?
Now, there's the challenge, isn't it? And I think we have, and again, if you've not listened to the reviews we've done in the past, I apologize, because obviously we have addressed this very issue numerous times before, but it's good to keep addressing it because we keep getting new listeners all around the world, and especially young folks are being challenged within their educational context by this very kind of assertion. Now, there are many people, sadly, many of my Muslim friends have fallen into the repeat whatever Bart Ehrman says, wash, repeat, don't think about what Bart Ehrman says trap, and they just do that over and over again, and it's a shame. But there's the argument. And if we, as I've pointed out in the past, what Bart Ehrman does in this debate is he's moved the goalposts a little bit. And not a lot of folks recognized it because they don't know the field well enough to really recognize it. And here's the issue. What he's basically saying is, I'm not overly concerned about the textual variants that exist in the manuscript tradition that we have today. Not overly concerned about that. What I'm concerned about is the period before the manuscript tradition gives us sufficient breadth to start establishing a text. You're talking about a relatively short period of time. A relatively short period of time. In fact, if you're a liberal and you write the New Testament books late in the first century, then you're talking about a really short period of time. But what they're saying is, what Ehrman is saying is, well, we don't have manuscripts for the first 100 years or so. Of course, we don't have manuscripts of anything of the ancient world of the first 100 years or so. Can you imagine, for example, if this standard was used for the Old Testament? Well, we don't have anything with 100 years of Moses, so we can't have any idea what Moses actually says. So this is this hyper-skepticism, which has not been a part of critical scholarship up until this time period. But now it's become a part of it. And so you've got these manuscripts that start appearing, the papyri, and they're by different people. They come from different places, even though obviously the main place we find them is in places where the environment allows papyri to survive for 2,000 years. That's not going to be in a rainforest someplace. I mean, you take any modern book into a rainforest and you got it in there for a week and it's almost destroyed just simply by the moisture and everything else and the cheap paper that we use these days. So they're generally found in certain areas that have an arid enough climate to allow for their survival. But that doesn't mean that they're all being produced there. They get carried there, they get put in libraries, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is, you get these first papyri, and what if they were all copies of bad copies? Well, how do you respond to that? I've given you the basis for responding to that in the past, but we're just now touching on it now, and it actually is a good lead into something I'm going to play from my debate from the East London Mosque. So that's what I'll use as my tie-in, in essence. But how do you respond to that? First of all, you need, in your own mind, to understand what the issues are. What is it that I emphasized even in my debate with Bart Ehrman? It's a term called multifocality. Multiple audience, multiple writers, multiple places, multiple times. You do not have a single line of transmission of the text of the New Testament. If you did, then Bart Ehrman's skepticism would be warranted. If all we had was one line of transmission, if Paul hadn't sent his letters to different churches, if the Gospels hadn't gone all over the place, if we just had one line, then we'd have real problems. But we don't have just one line. We have a wide variety, of materials and wide variety of manuscript traditions to draw from. And so you have this, you have a copy made here and a copy made there and a copy made a couple hundred miles away, and they're at different times and they're transmitted to different places and all of these types of things. And as a result, you get textual variants, but you also have the answer to Bart Ehrman's question. He seems to be missing something very basic and something very, very important. And that is, when the New Testament text appears in history, as it begins to appear over here in this manuscript, over here in this manuscript, do we find textual variation between those manuscripts? Yes, we do. Do we find them to be giving different stories? No. The nature of the variation is consistent with what you would expect with the kind of transmission of the text that you'd experience given what history tells us about what Christians were going through. They were a religio illicita. They were under persecution. I just saw that I've got coming, finally, I'm not sure what took so long, but a book that I need to take a look at, of someone trying to argue that the Christian persecution, against all of history, the Christian persecution was made up. We just made it up. I have a feeling it has something to do with, well, they know that we're going to be persecuted in not too distant future, so see, they're just trying to make themselves martyrs, et cetera, that type of thing. But I don't know. We'll take a look at it. I'll report upon it once I have the opportunity of analyzing and taking a look at it. But the Christians in that first period of time, you've got the Neronian persecution, you've got persecution at the end of the first century, which was quite severe. The most severe persecution is actually later at the end of the third century into the beginning of the fourth century. But in that first period of time, you still have persecution. You have people having to move from place to place. They have to take their manuscripts with them. They can lose manuscripts. You have to turn your manuscripts over when the Roman soldiers wanted you to, et cetera, et cetera. You have all this stuff going on, and the kind of variation is consistent with the fact that you couldn't have the best scholars in the world and the best copyists in the world involved in the production of this thing. Christians themselves frequently had to make the copies and do it secretly. And so you have that kind of variation. But the point is, because it comes from so many different sources, the idea of some kind of massive corruption of the message makes no sense. What you've got here is Bart Ehrman putting forward a theory and not seemingly realizing that theory would demand a tremendous amount of evidence that should be available. In other words, if Ehrman is right, and the later manuscript tradition that we have is some kind of messed up, corrupted, doesn't represent the original type situation. Which he's not actually trying to say that because he would have to prove it, but he's just wanting to leave the door open to that. That's what our Muslim friends like Sami Amerdi and people like that are wanting to tell us. If that were the case, then with the discovery of earlier and earlier papyri that don't come from that same line, you would find manuscripts that are wildly different. Tell a completely different story. Is that what we find? No. So what is the fundamental corollary that must come from Ehrman's thesis? That for some reason, somehow, even though Christianity spread all across the known world, all we've found so far are copies of just one stream, the one line of corrupted manuscripts. The good stuff just went poof, disappeared. Hasn't left a single trace. Now, he will tell you that this is the most widely attested book of antiquity. He will tell you it is the earliest attested book of antiquity. But he won't tell you that his theory would require you to believe that by some amazing result of history, it's just the one corrupted line that we have any early manuscripts of. Now, you might say, well, actually, he's just saying that we just don't know. He's being a good agnostic. But again, for that theory to have any validity, what you'd see would be these massive differences. You know, you'd find two copies of the Gospel of Matthew. And you couldn't even tell they're both the Gospel of Matthew because they're so different. Jesus is in one, but some other dude's in the other. That kind of change. And everybody knows that's not in any way, shape, or form what you have in the manuscript history at all. So you just need to be aware of the fact. You need to understand the answer to this objection.
How do we know that our surviving manuscripts were copied from accurate copies instead of thoroughly erroneous ones?
The point is that nobody in the early church had the ability to differentiate so as to corrupt the text in that way and say, well, we're not going to copy those, we're only going to copy these. That's not how copying was being done. The Christians were a persecuted people. There wasn't any bureaucratic organization of copyists. That the non-existent head of the Christian church could say, we're going to use these, not going to use those. There wasn't any control. And so if you had the good manuscripts and the bad manuscripts, you'd have equal copies of both. And yet what we see when we look at the earliest manuscripts is we have a really consistent... Well, how did they know that P52 was from John chapter 18? Because it reads what chapter 18 says. That's why. If it was from something else, they wouldn't have even been able to recognize it. And so that's the answer to that particular question. And we need to recognize that that's the answer to that particular question. So I just wanted to touch on that because... You hear that kind of thing, and you know, here's the great Bart Ehrman, and la, 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 and my Muslim friends love quoting Bart Ehrman. Well, one of the things I wanted to do was, when I first listened to the debate from the East London Mosque, let me think back. Yeah, it was after I had listened to Zakir Hussain's next debate, which I believe was with David Wood in London. I found that he continued to do the machine gun or shotgun approach where after you make your opening statement, then in your rebuttal period, you just start throwing dirt in the air. You just bring up every topic known to man. You just throw it all out there. And hope something sticks. That's basically what he was doing. And so I went back and I listened to our debate quite some time ago. And I thought, you know what? In his rebuttal period, Zakir Hussain was doing this. There is a response to every single thing he said, maybe just for his benefit, but for the benefit of others as well. It'd be good to go back through that and demonstrate the wild inconsistencies of Islamic apologists who engage in this type of behavior. Because I think what I decided was I wasn't going to do that if Zakir Hussain showed that he had heard me saying, don't do that. And no, we're not, I'll go to suggest, we are not talking about the Vice President Biden's suggestion that you fire both barrels from your porch. That's not what we're talking about. I want to make sure that we don't want to get any politics involved here at all. We are not talking about Vice. I have not suggested that Vice President Biden is a secret Muslim. I did not make that suggestion. Somebody else may have, but I did not. So anyway, we're going to get to this in context, but what I decided to do was, since he's going to continue down this road, I'm going to respond to Zakir Hussain in the rebuttal period. And I'm just looking at the screen here. And what I do is in Audio Note Taker, I make a different color each subject. And I've only gone through, I don't know, the first 10 minutes or maybe less of the rebuttal. And the colors are, it's a rainbow explosion of color. Why? Because there's so many different topics that are raised in just in a rat-a-tat-tat way. But just to give you the connection here, here's the connection. Here's the connection to Bart Ehrman. He, of course, quotes Bart Ehrman. And might quote Bart Ehrman in this, I'm not sure. But just listen to this kind of statement in regards to the text of the New Testament. This reflects how many Muslims understand it. The Sami Ameri book is only going to make more Muslims have the same twisted, inaccurate, untrue view of the text of the New Testament. But here it is.
Page 10 of Bart Ehrman's book, Misquoting Jesus, actually mentions all you have are copies of the copies of the copies, and they've all got different readings. And if you don't like Bart Ehrman, if he's too liberal for you, actually he's agnostic, I'll call Bruce Metzger, who in the preface to the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible actually says that the scholars have got different manuscripts and all they do is try their best to find the original reading. Exactly what the Quran says in Surah 4:157, they follow nothing but conjecture, nothing is serious, it's all doubts. Though on the sermons in church, they preach it like they know exactly what the original writer said.
So, there you have Zakir Hussain. And first he quotes the copies of the copies of the copies comment from Bart Ehrman. And he normally throws more copies in there than that. And then you have Bruce Metzger. Now, if you're going to accurately represent Bruce Metzger, then you should at least quote his own statements where his own study of the text of the New Testament has led him to the conclusion of the accuracy of that text and the propriety of having faith in Jesus Christ. That's if you're going to be fair, but it's really hard to ask some of these guys from the Islamic side to be fair because they're really precluded from doing so by their own theological system, as far as I understand it, as some of them see it. But be that as it may, what was even said there, saying that editors examine the material, you know, that would, if Zakir Hussain's going to actually quote this type of stuff, you think it might be good if he would take the time to actually read the textual commentary in the Greek New Testament that the UBS editors put out that Metzger edited? You know, to have some knowledge of what they're talking about. I don't get the feeling he's done that. He's not just simply saying that a bunch of editors sat around and, you know, they tossed dice or, you know, played cards to figure out which reading to put in or anything like that. This is serious stuff. And you're only talking about looking at serious manuscript evidence and things like that. And then he connects that. This is the amazing part. He connects that to Surah 4:157. Now, you should know what that is. If you've been listening to this program for almost any time at all, you should know Surah 4:157. Almost, it's the one ayah of the Quran that I keep saying you need to know what this ayah is. You all know it, right? It is the one verse, the 40 Arabic words. The 40 Arabic words. We've even got a video on it. A music video on the 40 Arabic words. It's the only place in the Quran where the crucifixion is denied. Placing the Quran inalterably in opposition to all of recorded history itself. And here you have the claim on the part of the Jews, we killed the Messiah, Jesus, the son of Mary, but they killed him not. It was made to appear to them. Shebi halaham. It made to appear to them. And some interpret that to mean someone was made to look like him and the substitution theory and all the rest of that stuff. But it goes on to say those who differ therein are full of doubts with no certain knowledge. It's just, they're just following conjecture or speculation. Now the funny thing is, here you have the Quran in a verse where there is no hadith interpretation. There is no interpretation of these words that come from Muhammad himself. Nobody for 200 years can remember a single thing Muhammad ever said about these words. And they've been interpreted a multitude of different ways by Muslims themselves. And in the middle of that, a clearly non-mubinun, non-clear text that is against all of history, Zakir Hussain can quote that and try to connect it to what Bruce Metzger was saying about the state of the text of the New Testament. That they're just following speculation. As if the readings that the UBS committee chose were conjectural emendations when they were not. They're all based upon manuscript evidence from the ancient world. And it's we Christians that produce critical texts of our New Testament. Still waiting on that critical text of the Quran, aren't we? Yeah, we don't have that. We have to go over to this source over here and find out about the Sa'ana Palimpsest manuscripts, and we go over here and read about the Fogg's Palimpsest manuscripts, and we read the early Tafsir literature and find out about the variations in the Razm. All the rest of that stuff, we have to put it all together, but you can just go and pick up one volume. It's a whole lot easier, isn't it? Yeah, because we're a whole lot more open with the textual history of our work, which, by the way, is considerably longer than yours and considerably older than yours, and hence would be in a completely different scholarly realm as far as its transmission. And I ain't even talking about the Old Testament here. So the apples to oranges stuff here, I'm just going to start. We need to have a debate with somebody where we really focus upon this very thing. And that is the Quran, a single author work, a single author medieval work, because that's where it comes from. I mean, if you make the 6th century the dividing line for the medieval period, the end of antiquity, it's a medieval work, it's not a work of antiquity. A single author medieval work that is 57% the length of the New Testament, words-wise, to compare its textual transmission to the multi-authored work of the New Testament, which is considerably older and considerably bigger and has multiple authors, and then the even larger work of the Old Testament, which is much older and more authors. Well, how can anyone defend that on any scholarly level at all? Well, you can make all the assertions you want, but how can you defend that? It's obviously not how things should be done. And so, what I'm going to do, I just wanted to point that out. I do want to make note, I am well aware of the Sami Ameri book, Hunting for the Word of God. I've got it. I've got it on Kindle. I've already recorded it. I'm working through it. I started reading on Kindle while I traveled back to Charlotte. After I got through the first chapter into the second one, I realized, you know what? There is just so much really bad stuff. I mean, just massive ignorance of the sources being handled. I mean, I'm sorry, Mr. Ameri, but it's just unbelievable. The conclusions that you will draw from a little quote here and a little quote there, for those of us who actually read the stuff that you're quoting from, just makes our heads spin. It's just Not respectful at all. It's not respectful scholarship, even though he calls himself a scholar of this stuff. I realized that he also really you know, like for example, he'll quote Dan Wallace, and he'll say, Dan Wallace furiously asserted something like this. And it's from one of his debates. Dan Wallace furiously? Do you know Dan Wallace? I mean, I'm the kind of guy always saying, Dan, pick up the passion on this thing here, you know? I mean, Dan is just the most even keel type guy around, and it's just like, really? Furiously? This is a lot of that stuff. So what I actually did is I went back to the start and started all over again. What I'm doing on Kindle is I'm marking all the stuff. Just mark, put it, highlight. And then you can go back afterwards. You can look at all those highlights, pull them out, copy them, and I'll have a fairly full list of egregious errors on Sammy Ameri's part. But even then, I stopped doing that. Why? Because Sammy Ameri begins his book by saying, I was prompted to do this because I found this book in the library, and it's one of the most amazing, excellent, glorious books that's ever been written from the Islamic perspective. And I knew what it was. And I said, it's about time that I spend the time on this one, too. It's called Itzar al-Haq. It's from 1864. It's from India initially. It was the book that was written that torpedoed British missionary efforts amongst the Muslims there in India at that time. And it's where the Muslims, Ahmadinejad, he ran across the book. That's what launched him into being into Islamic Dawah. And Sami Ameri and Adnan Rashid, when he was staying there at the University of the first debate we did in Dublin, University College Dublin. He's got on his laptop, because I'm sitting behind him, I can see it, a list of all these alleged contradictions. You just scroll through them, reading these contradictions. You know where they came from? Itzar al-Haq. Itzar al-Haq. All goes back to Itzar al-Haq. So I have Itzar al-Haq on my iPod. I started on it prior to the trip over to Dublin. Been a little bit disrupted. And if you look at my calendar, I'm going to remain disrupted as far as traveling goes for quite some time. But I'm going to keep working on it. It's only 19 hours worth of listening just for that one. Hopefully make some progress on. But I've got that. I've got N.T. Wright. I've got all the Muslim, Mu'adh Malik. I mean, I just need to stop doing everything else and just start writing for the next 3 months, and I might get it all done, but that's what I'm working on. So I am well aware of those things. But anyways, I can guarantee you that Zakir Hussain has spent a fair amount of time with Itzar al-Haq, or at least with those who have been influenced by Itzar al-Haq. And so this kind of scattergun approach, throw everything out. It's what you're going to encounter on the campus, that kind of thing. And so we're going to look at that. And all that background has left me with just a few moments. So let me just grab one of these. And hopefully I'll remember this when I come back over these. I'll have to change their color or something so I can check out this argument. I should have enough time to throw this in before the end of the hour. We've only got 5 minutes. Check out this argument.
Now, let me get to the first point. Dr. James White mentioned that the Quran says in Surah 61:6 that Jesus spoke of somebody to come after him, whose name shall be Ahmed. And Dr. James White said, where are these words that Jesus said? But Dr. White, I challenge you to show me anywhere in the text where it says it's in the Protestant canon. We know historically Christians had many Gospels. In fact, I've got Bar Ehrman's book in front of me, and Dr. James White, respects him, I'm sure, who mentions that different churches had many different Gospels. When the Quran tells them to remember, the Quran is simply reminding them of things they forgot. Why did they forget it? Because they chose the canons that suited them.
So, did you catch that? Did you follow that argument? See, here's the problem. The Quran says, remember when Jesus said this. Now, that would have to be meaningful to the people to whom he's speaking, or the word remember would be ridiculous. So, and I did point this out in my response to Zakir Hussain. If the Christians to whom these are addressed, if these words are going to have any meaning to them, then they'd have to know what Muhammad was referring to. They'd have to know what the Quran is talking about. And so I asked Zakir Hussain, Okay. You say it's not in the quote-unquote Protestant canon? There's the, all these other Gospels that Bart Ehrman's talking about? Oh, where is it? Where is this prophecy of Jesus? Is it in the Gospel of Thomas? Gospel of Peter? Gospel of Mary? Which Gospel? Which Gospel is it? And can you demonstrate that the people who were listening to Muhammad at that time, that they would have had access to these things? That they were... I mean, it's clear that from Muhammad's perspective, some of that Gnostic stuff was part of the Gospel. There's no question about that, because he incorporated it into the Quran. And he didn't have any discernment as to what was historical and what was not. And so he has Jesus speaking from his cradle, and that came from the Arabic infancy Gospel. It was written in the 5th century. And there's all sorts of pre-existing sources the Quran uses, even though the Quran says it didn't. It's clear that it did. The Quran's an error on those issues. And so if he wants to go to those Gospels that the Quran itself uses and admit that the Quran's an error because it used these Gospels, okay, that's fine. But I said, can you find us where the Christians in the days of Muhammad were using these things and thought that they were, in fact, the words of Jesus? Now, just because your author was confused about that doesn't mean that the Christians were confused about that. And remember, not only that, but as I pointed out in my opening, in the Hadith, the story is told of a young Jewish boy who, when Muhammad passed by, he recognized that Muhammad was prophesied in the Torah. Now, how did he know that? How did he know that? Because you see, the claim of Surah 7, 157, is that the people of the book find these things in their scriptures. So you'd have to prove that they thought those books were scripture, and that they themselves saw these things. So much so that a little Jewish boy who was dying would recognize Muhammad as the one prophesied by the scriptures. Now, he tried to do that by going to Song of Solomon 5:16. And I think we pointed out just how amazingly bad that argumentation is. But that's the kind of stuff that's out there. And notice, here you've got Muslims. Now, Bart Ehrman would listen to this man's argument and go, you've got to be kidding me. But he's afraid of Muslims. He's afraid of the subject of Islam. So he won't talk about it. You know, he's been asked, when are you going to write a book similar about the Quran? And what was his answer? When I no longer value my life. That was his answer. We've played it on the air. But he would, here you have the Muslims, and they grab these arguments and they try to tie them together with what people like Ehrman are saying in ways that these scholars would never, ever accept. But they don't care. They don't care about the inconsistency of the conclusions they're coming to. And that's the problem. We will pick up with more from Zakir Hussain and all the rest of this stuff next time on The Dividing Line. See you then. God bless.
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again this Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. for The Dividing Line.